All right, guys, let's get going. We ran a little bit over their starting time.
Actually, yeah, we are.
We are? All right.
So they got our whole conversation.
Yep. All right. Welcome to the EFF panel on the NDAA. It's the National Defense Authorization Act. My name is Jeff Termeseisen. I have a degree in political science, and I'm working on a master's in cybersecurity. I worked for 12 years for a company that did surveillance of audio and video, and I'm currently working for a company that's financial processing.
My name is Blair Chintella. I'm an attorney here in Atlanta while moving to Douglas. I've been following these issues for a long time. So, you want to lead it off about description? Or I can.
Yeah, well, where it came from, right. Where it evolved from.
So, who here is familiar with the NDAA in some degree? Wow. Okay. For those of you who don't know, the NDAA was a piece of legislation passed this year, and it's something that's passed every year by Congress, and it includes a lot of things in it, money for the military and stuff like that. But there's a couple sections in this year's that are really concerning from a civil rights point of view. So that's... It's kind of there are two sections really that are really contentious. The first is section 1021 and section 1022, or the second one section 1022. Section 1021 basically reaffirms the president's ability to do whatever is necessary to fight the war on terror. And if you remember back after the September 11th attacks, the Congress passed the authorization to use military force, which is basically a blanket permission slip just to go out and do whatever is necessary to combat terrorism and hold those accountable who attacked us on September 11th. And so you've obviously seen all the wars happening since then, and that's pretty much all that's been done under that authorization. So it's extremely vague, vaguely worded. And so the President Bush, now President Obama, that's what they justified under all their actions and stuff. So really the NDAA, the first section reaffirms the ability of the President to do that. But the AUMF that was passed in 2001, was only restricted to those people who were responsible for the September 11th attacks. But the NDAA, Section 1021, expands that, just makes it even more broad. So the way it's defined is anyone engaged in hostilities or who does a belligerent act against the United States, which I'll leave it up to you to try and define what a belligerent act is.
But pretty much the war on drugs with the military.
Yeah.
This one also authorized the use of the military within the U.S. borders. Not directly, but it can be read that right. Way is pretty much suspending the Posse Comitatus Act.
Right. So it doesn't define. Another problem is it says any person can be detained. That's Section 1022, which I'll read that in a little bit here. But Section 1022 says any person can basically be detained till the end of hostilities. Now,
Korea.
When can anyone remember when we haven't been at war or when there hasn't been hostilities? Because I can't. I mean, as far as our country's history, it's pretty hard to...
There was like a couple years after the Civil War or something.
Yeah, maybe a couple years of actual... Right.
Oh, that's right.
Save your Confederate dollars, you know. But so that's the problem with it, and it's not limited in geographic scope either. So technically, it would apply to, you know, someone found in the United States or U.S. citizens,
or
any person. What's that?
Or demonoid,
I guess, since corporations are people now, right?
That's not applied.
So, yeah. No, but right after that Supreme Court decision, someone mockingly tried to get a corporation to run for office.
Are any of the public offices limited to natural persons or just persons?
I think there's one requirement that an artificial entity couldn't satisfy. I don't remember off the top of my head, but it was hilarious. So I have to look that up again.
Birth certificate.
Something like that.
That's not required anymore.
Oh, I didn't know we were going to touch on somebody.
I got this guy in an alley that can help you out.
I have a question. I was reading online that
there's just rumors that were online that if you now you file a UCC-1 form and transfer your assets from the, well, let's face it, the identity created through your birth certificate, the all-capitalized name, down to a lowercase name, which is the natural sovereign person, that there's actually, right now in Congress, there's actually a law going through that's going to be considered an act of domestic terrorism, because you're basically going to be, you know, because it's probably one of the biggest fears, because America, since March 9th, 1933, we've been in a state of bankruptcy. And so basically the collateral that was created through your birth certificate at birth to cover the national debt, you're pretty much freeing yourself from it. And they're saying now they're going to try to pass it as a as act of terrorism. But the thing is that if they do pass that law, they're kind of be exposing the threat. So, I mean, the fraud has been going on since, you know, FDR signed the Emergency Banking Act, which pretty much created all this through the... Because before FDR signed that, we didn't have birth certificates. If you look at Black Law's Dictionary, a certificate is a claim on property. Just like when a ship comes to port, back to maritime admiralty law, every product is issued a birth certificate. Like every car that comes off a ship is getting a birth certificate because you're basically a product under maritime admiralty law. So basically they're saying since you're a proper United States corporation that you are now committing an act of terrorism by simply freeing your name through a UCC.
Well, you know, when I was in the military, we called our social security numbers serial numbers.
Yeah.
It's your employee ID for the United States corporation. That's pretty much what it is.
I mean, and basically everyone goes like, oh, we can't have a national ID. You've got a national ID. It's your social security number. No one else in the country has it. It is a unique identifier. And, they don't have to try and pass a national ID. You've already got it.
I think you were talking about the sovereign citizen movement. I'm not that familiar with that, actually. But so if
back to maritime admiralty law, because they say since your body is 90% water, and since you were born with water, you support magic. You are the product of maritime admiralty law. Therefore, you are considered salvage.
Well,
that'd be an interesting legal argument.
The question is, how does that tie into the topic at hand, which is NDAA? That's the question. I guess if they classified you as a terrorist, then they could hold you indefinitely.
Hello. Okay, I have to test these things because, yeah. The 2012
is the problematic one.
Okay.
Yeah.
There was one, it might have been this year, I watched the news, I can't keep my years together though. What was the one that Obama had a signing statement for where he said, yeah, sure, I'll sign this into law, but I'm not going to enforce it during my administration?
That's this one.
The interesting thing I noticed about that one was that the percentage of Congress, House and Senate, that said, yeah, we want to do this, was well over 90%. So you want to talk about bipartisan agreement on something,
right?
They had it. And so I think that's where Obama's signing statement came from. I have seen in politics that Obama's taken a lot of heat for something that, had he gone against it, he would have totally alienated all of everyone.
Well, it's not just this one provision. It includes money for the military and a bunch of things.
That's what every year's NDAA typically involves. It's monetary for the military, right? I guess my question then is, you are mentioning NDAAs under Bush to follow a trend of citizen disempowerment over, since 9/11. What are the specific, do you know the specific year of the NDAAs, aside from just this one, that Obama has said that, I'm not going to touch this, you're not going to have to worry about it for the next, probably next 4 years. Can you track that over the years?
Unfortunately, I don't have like a timeline of, how NDAAs over time have gotten worse. I'm more knowledgeable about this particular one. I see it's bad just by looking at it. I haven't, but that'd be an interesting question. I could look into.
I mean, in general, the idea behind the NDAA is a good thing. We want to give the military money. We want to give them the tools. The problem is that this one has sort of started moving away from that to one. We know this is going to be a bad thing because simply of how it's worded. And two, Congress has a very bad track record of expanding, saying, all right, we're going to write it this way so we can do X, and then finding ways that they can do X, Y, Z, and the rest of the alphabet as well. So that's really the big problem here, is that in and of itself, it's a necessary thing. I mean, we want a defense force. You know, we want to make sure that they can go out and do what they need to do. The real problem is, though, that this gives them so much power if they want to use it. I mean, the Posse Comitatus Act was, you know, one of the founding things, like, you will not deploy military within the U.S. borders, which is why you've got the National Guard. You know, they're supposed to fulfill that role where the military can. And this one's basically now going, it's like, yeah, if we're going to send the Marines, we'll send the Marines in wherever. You know, so you can have Army deployed to, you know, Nebraska. You can have Marines deployed to, you know, Alaska, wherever. And that's where that issue comes. And you'll hear a lot of talk about the indefinite detention. And folk are going, yeah, it's not indefinite. It's specifically worded until hostility ends. But as he says, like, hostility never ends. I mean, that's why I mentioned Korea, because there was never a peace treaty signed in Korea. Technically, North and South Korea are still at war, and we're still involved. You know, so technically it's not indefinite, but for all practical purposes, can you think of any way that it's not?
I don't think that. Yeah, under the literal terms of the statute, I think it could be indefinite, basically. As long as there are hostilities, which is what the statute says. And I can't remember a time when there haven't been, so. But I guess Section 1021, I can read it real quick for you. It says, Congress affirms that the authority of the President to use all necessary and appropriate force pursuant to the AUMF includes the authority for the armed forces of the United States to detain covered persons. And then, of course, there's a definition section that defines what a covered person is. It says, detained covered persons pending disposition under the laws of war. Let's see here.
Now, would laws of war be Geneva Conventions or what we consider laws of war?
I'm not sure about that. Laws of war is pretty vague.
I mean, because so that, that could really just be rules of engagement.
Right.
But this is pretty much anyone. So, you know, it could apply equally to someone who's actually in uniform on the opposite side as well as to civilian.
So the first section there is defines as a covered person. There are two types of covered persons. First is category. It's defined as anyone who planned, authorized, committed, aided, or harbored the terrorists who attacked the U.S. on September 11, 2001. So that's limited to that event and the people connected with that event. The second definition...
and this is the one you don't usually hear about.
This is the one that is insane. Basically, says here, a person who was a part of or substantially supported Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or associated forces that are engaged in hostilities against the United States or its coalition partners, including any person who has committed a belligerent act or has directly supported such hostilities in aid of such enemy forces.
So you're fine up to that or. Because the first part sounds like it limits it pretty much to the Al-Qaeda lot, and then they hit that or right. Anybody that, you know, has ever said a bad thing about the U.S.
So it's if you support Al-Qaeda, Taliban, those listed entities, they're engaged in hostilities against the United States, you know, or anyone who commits a belligerent act, which, what is a belligerent act? Maybe setting a bomb off is a belligerent act, and therefore you lose all your constitutional rights, and then you're going to be detained, you know.
Swearing at a police officer.
Possibly, I don't
know.
You know,
interfering with an arrest, that would, you know.
Certainly seems belligerent to me.
Sure.
You know, that's...
So. Firstly, don't ever say anything to a police officer besides your name.
One thing about that, yes, that's a good thing, but be aware that you will probably be arrested. You will have to go through the whole process of being fingerprinted and whatnot until your lawyer can come and you can talk to your lawyer. That is a good thing, but bear in mind there is a downside that cops just not going to go, all right, you're not talking to me, you can go. They'll be like, not a problem. We'll arrest you, read you your rights, take you downtown, and you can take it up with the judge and your lawyer.
Okay, then. I also wanted to point out, I had read somewhere that a lower court, had challenged some of the clauses in the NDA applying to indefinite imprisonment. Is that changed the wording of the law as is right now?
I think even like 12 states have filed protests against how it's worded.
Yeah, I know. I think it was Kentucky or Pennsylvania adopted a resolution basically saying that it's unconstitutional and they're not going to obey it. I think one other state actually passed a law or something making it a crime, so it's kind of like a kidnapping crime if the federal government enforces the law, which you could argue this probably is kidnapping if that's the way they enforce it. But I know a lot of states are rebelling, which, you know, is a good thing, I think. But this is where, you know, section 1021C says, detention under the law of war without trial until the end of the hostilities authorized by the AUMF. The AUMF, is that 2001 law. So if this were enacted back in 2001, there could possibly be someone who had been detained up until now under this statute. So
without trial.
Without trial.
Now, question, with the wording they changed in this year's one, prior to that, so we had like John Walker Lynn or John Lynn Walker, who was arrested, detained on a Gitmo, and got released to U.S. custody because he's a citizen. With a change in this law now, does that sort of invalidate that? So you can still file the protest, but they can just go, yeah, no, we've already covered that, and we don't have to, you know, follow the same things that happened previously.
Yeah, it changes it in a couple respects. So there's the issue of the writ of habeas corpus, which you're supposed to get to challenge your detention. And so moving on to section 1022, it says that, let me put it out here. It says they shall, for anyone who's not a U.S. citizen, they shall detain people who are found to fall into this section. So it's mandatory. So, and it's not just the government, it's the military who shall detain people. And if you're a U.S. citizen, statute says the requirement in paragraph 1 shall apply to any person, says the requirement does not apply to U.S. citizens. So it says you're not required to detain people, you know, without a trial, or basically without a trial, if they're a U.S. citizen, but it doesn't say you can't. So it still gives them permission. And there's a little, you know, that's the way the statutes are written. You know, there are various ways you interpret them. Yeah. See, people who write them are smart, you know, they write them intentionally vague sometimes.
Right.
Yeah.
And also with it being the military detaining them, it means they no longer fall under the civilian laws. They fall under the UCMJ.
It says a competent tribunal. I think that's the language it uses. So, I mean, it could be a military court. You could argue that it's a military court. You could argue that a normal Article 3 constitutional court is, you know, so it could be a number of different types of courts. Maybe they'll create a special court, you know, with even less rights or more. But,
wow.
So, yeah, it's very concerning from, yeah.
Okay.
First, I'll start off by saying that I believe both Democrats and Republicans prefer statism over individual rights. That's proven by their voting records, so they're both equally guilty on this. I also think the Supreme Court is supporting this statist actions and votes and laws and obscure regulations, whatever you want to call it. Would it not be easier, even though probably political suicide, for us to just go ahead and constitutionally declare war on Al-Qaeda and any sister or related terrorist groups that would fall within the Constitution, thereby binding it to previously standards that our nations followed traditionally and make it less murky? Yeah. What are your opinions on that?
As far as declaring war, I was curious about that. I did a little research on it, and it doesn't always require a declaration or something passed by Congress. And the Supreme Court, one case, held that Congress's inaction, basically their failure to object to a war that the executive branch starts, is consent, is sufficient under the Constitution. You know, but under the Constitution, Congress has the ability to declare war. They're the ones who declare war. But the Supreme Court has interpreted that to mean that if they do nothing when the president goes to war, then that's sufficient.
Yeah, because so, the president can do what, 90 days? Does that count as declaring war? Or is that sort of like a gray area until 90 days expires and either they approve it or don't?
Well, President Obama went past that deadline several times.
Right, but yeah. I mean, well, it's really Congress's deadline, isn't it? That's pretty much their thing that says either we have to stop it or we, by default, we're approving of it by our silence.
Right. I'm not sure about that interaction between that law and the...
Right.
Yeah.
One thing I also want to mention with SCOTUS, the Supreme Court, is that, and I see this a lot in the arguments as to like why they're bad and everything they're doing, they're really pretty limited in what they can do. All that the court can do is rule on the law as it's written. So in many cases, they will uphold something as being right, even though they know it's not right, but they're going by essentially what their job is, which is interpret the law. To actually change that law, it's got to go back to Congress and the legislature and have them change it there. So barring something where it's where it's going against the previous thing, they are extremely limited to what they can do as far as stopping or approving actions that aren't already in law somewhere. And most of the time, you'll see, especially these really controversial ones, they'll say, there's nothing we can do about this. We're upholding it as it stands because there's no reason it shouldn't stand legally. And we think it should be changed, but you're going to have to go talk to Congress about that.
So the 10th Amendment is irrelevant?
Well, no, I think, the states, my understanding is that the states can pass, their constitutions can afford citizens more rights than the federal constitution, but they can't go give less rights. A lot of states, that's why you're getting some traction in that area. The states are rebelling because there's that Supreme Court precedent saying that. So I don't think, I guess to answer your question, I think it's important, that states do that kind of thing.
But then that was sort of historically crushed during the Civil War.
And what do you mean?
Judging pro-con.
Just grab the talking stick there, otherwise we can't get you on tape.
I was going to say, not judging pros or cons on slavery, the southern states did try to secede when the nation went one way, they wanted to go another. And the Civil War more or less decided, screw you, the national government.
The national government is the ultimate honcho. That's it. State rights, dead.
Right.
Done with.
The Constitution says that the theory is that there are enumerated powers, and that the enumerated powers are given to the federal government, and all remaining powers are given to the states.
Right.
And if you don't approve, there is a process by which you go through, and really armed insurrection isn't it, which is where the law, where the Civil War came in from. If you take that route, it usually does boil down to who's got the bigger guns.
Yeah, when the laws fall apart, it's just arbitrary force, what it comes down to.
Yeah.
Okay, so because given the political climate, no congressman who wants to retain his seat is going to come out in favor of lowering the hysteria and come out against NDA enough to repeal it, let alone the Patriot Act. I can't imagine any president wanting to back away from being handed more power.
Right.
Short of getting the Supreme Court, replacing them with clones and having them repeal it, do we have any real options?
Yeah, write to your Congress people. Go down, lobby them.
Did you see step one, the part of them being losing their seat? If anyone says, yes, I'm against, taking, because his opponent will say, oh, you take a weapon against away from terrorist hunters. They're going to lose they're going to lose the election.
It's real, and that gets really up to the people. If you disagree with, let's say the senator says, all right, we're going to approve this. His constituency says, no, you won't. Even if he's for it, he'll still lose the election. So which way they go really doesn't matter as far as that goes. It's going to depend on how the voters are going to be voting on that. So if the voters oppose it, even if they're absolutely for it and they're part of the 90% and whatnot, they're still going to lose their seat. So as far as that goes, yeah, talking to your congressfolk really, really does make a difference there because you can tell them, I don't approve of the way you're voting. And other than the president, no one in Congress owes the country anything as far as votes go. The only people that anybody but the president answers to are the folk who vote for them directly. And that, as you come down the chain, that group gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. So, any of our state senators, rest of the country doesn't matter because they're not voting for our state senators, only we are. They all say, hey, we're working for the country, and they all project the idea that we're looking out for everyone. but they're really looking out for their state in particular, because that's the only one that they care about, because that's where their voters are. And then again, congressional, they go down, they only care about their district, really. Now, that doesn't mean that they don't work with others to promote the general welfare, but when push comes to shove, they'll do what their voters will say, or they'll lose their seat, and that becomes their choice. Even if they're like the only person against something, fantastic. But if it's what their voters want, it means that next time they're still going to be there at, when Congress, you know, comes together again. And that's really what they care about. And if you can influence that, you can pretty much get them to dance to you whatever tune you want.
I think the answer to your earlier question, there was, or someone asked, I think it was you, sir, but there was a court case, a court ruled that that part was unconstitutional.
So does that mean that it can be challenged in court and should the clause be activated?
Yeah, that's basically what the lawsuit was about. Challenging it. I think it was a declaratory judgment action. So instead of you want to do something that may substantially support some organization that's our enemy, and so you file something with the court saying, "Tell me if I did this, whether it would be illegal." Instead of doing it and then running the risk that you lose. But the government came back and they said, "Okay, well, this case or the court's ruling, we're interpreting only to apply to that person." So, yeah, we're not going to go do anything under the NDAA to that person, but that doesn't prevent us from just continuing on doing it to other people. And that was sort of they twisted the words of the court, or they improperly interpreted, who am I to say? It's the judge that makes that call. But it seemed pretty clear to me that it was a bad interpretation. So.
Yeah, actually, that was kind of my question, if you could talk about the court case that was brought by Noam Chomsky, Chris Hedges, Daniel Ellsberg, and others, and what they felt that the impact would be on journalism, specifically.
I think this goes back largely to the broad definition of belligerent. You don't necessarily have to take up arms to be belligerent. If you start writing nasty op-ed pieces that go against the status quo, that could be interpreted as inciting revolt, which would absolutely be a belligerent act. Even if it's not, hey, take up arms, depending on how loosely they want to interpret that, simply saying, hey, vote against your senator because they support the NDAA could be, you're looking to overthrow the government.
I don't think that was it. It was more being concerned that they would be associated with Al-Qaeda people as journalists and things like that.
That's what I'm saying, though, is that it's an extremely broad, because your journalists are working with Al-Qaeda in many situations. They're not supporting them or anything, but they want to get the story. So they're not telling the forces where these folk are, because they don't want to get shot next time they go into these combat zones. They're reporting the folk, they're taking the pictures, they're getting those folks' story out. Again, it comes to that broad definition of what belligerent counts for, because specifically in reporting there, you could say that they're generating sympathy for the enemy. So as far as that goes, it comes back to that very vague terminology that they're using and how they want to interpret it at any point. And as far as I know, no one actually ever asks them, define what you mean by this, do they?
In that court case, they did, and the government's response was basically, well, we're not going to give you an answer. We're not going to give example, because the judge was asking, what do you mean by substantially supporting? Because when a statute is written, it's supposed to be reasonably specific so ordinary people can understand what's prohibited. And so the court is asking them, if a person is going to read it and know what not to do, what does this mean? What is substantially supported? And the government didn't give an answer and basically said that we're not going to give you an example. So they're almost conceding that they can't really, or it's basically it covers almost anything.
And the net effect is becomes a case-by-case basis. And if someone who, for example, gets tried in, say, a California court will have a very different jury and process than someone, in the Deep South. So just on where it's that sort of thing held, you can have a vastly different court case and outcome for exactly the same case.
I mean, there are some people asking the question of whether an attorney, like providing legal services to someone who's substantially supporting these organizations, can be held liable or detained, I guess. Yeah. anyone giving any aid, legal advice, money, anything to any of these organizations, you know, that's how broad it is.
Intel.
Right. Intel, carrying their suitcase for them, I don't know.
Yeah. Intimidated.
Right.
Good question. Okay, him then.
I kind of want to go back to the president having 90 days. That was, when did that start? The late 1700s, early
8th? War Powers Act or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
When was that?
I think it's pretty much been there forever.
Right, you know, I mean, the point is, at the time that was put in, being able to have a working internet with other people across the world through a global network and send out drones was probably not something Ben Franklin had in mind. Well, Ben Franklin might have, but, you know. But I guess the concern is if you can meet with the Pentagon at 7 a.m., you know, gather all your intel, coordinate something by 11 p.m. or 11 a.m. that same day, you've committed a genocide, and at noon you're off to lunch. That doesn't quite have the same intention, I think, in our modern day that act was intended to have back in the 1800s, when it takes 90 days just to barely rally an army and send it somewhere.
That's a good point. You know, the Constitution doesn't say that we have the right to create an Air Force, either.
Sure.
Our Constitution said we've got a right to privacy.
Well, because the Air Force wasn't invented, or the airplanes weren't invented.
Right, you know, right. So,
but that's a judicial interpretation. So, like, courts will go there and they'll say, okay, it says Army, Navy, and Coast Guard, I think.
Yeah.
But then they go, okay, well, if an Air Force had existed, then the drafters would have included that in there. So obviously they meant to include all armed forces in general. And that's how they interpreted it. So,
yeah.
You know, that's difference between, like, strict textualism interpretations and then, you know, spirit of the...
Right.
Yeah.
And so my question then is, you know, like I said, Obama said that, you know, he's not going to do this. So let's just pretend that he gets reelected. We're comfortable till 2016, theoretically, hopefully, right? 2017, somebody comes in who's a little less, whatever. In that time, this theoretical president, this theoretical executive, wants to declare war on this terrorist cell, which is Americans. So does that executive then have the power to say, oh, no, I have 90 days to do this before Congress can act? Because at that crucial time, I don't think we have 90 days of let's rally the troops and try to do this on a grassroots level to co-opt that presidential or executive power.
No, Congress can step in like on day one. You know, in your example there, Congress can step in at 1 p.m. It's just that if nothing's happened by 90 days, you got to stop.
Oh, okay.
So it's not that the president gets a free ride for 90 days. It's just that after 90 days, you can't... The war cannot continue on his authority alone beyond that point. Well, Obama. Originally.
Originally.
Now Congress they can go on by, you know, Congress's silent consent by not... Exactly.
Yeah.
But, yeah, they can step in, you know, 1 p.m. and say, all right, you're done.
Okay.
And
all right.
They can end it right there. Guy on the far side. In the Suki shirt.
yeah, I know. I was going to say, do you want me to come over?
Yeah.
Don't think anybody needs any ear piercing stuff. Okay. Given the fact that my brother did kind of point out the whole trying to get Congress to actually change their ways, change their current path towards legislation for more control, let's say that the law is not going to be overturned or redone or revamped for, let's say, at least a year. Let's say that theoretically, under hypothetical circumstances, if they weren't wanting to apply this law to, say, Dragon Con, you know, the where the instigators really come from. But anybody who would express a free thought or something like that, are you saying that like people in this room would really have to worry? Because, I mean, I have been known to jaywalk on occasion, and I have built doghouses without pulling permits before, and that is all technically illegal. Are you saying that they would actually try to use such a as you put it, and I agree wholeheartedly, it should be more specific, yes. Some kind of vague outline, yes, would be helpful. But mm-hmm. if you're talking about
vague sweeping powers, would they actually try to use it on everyday citizens for any little thing?
As a practical matter, no, I don't think.
Okay.
But I think that the political backlash would be too much, and so I think the strategy would be to just use it in rare circumstances. But the fact that it exists in any circumstances was concerning.
Well, it's very concerning, but right. Has anyone been arrested yet? Or would we even know?
I'm not aware of any people yet.
Okay.
Are you aware of anyone yet?
Well, it's been Yeah, right. Exactly. I mean,
right. I don't know if we would know. There was this Marine who was recently taken, but I don't think that was under the NDAA. Yeah.
And if you are incarcerated, and let's say that you could be detained for like years, what are your avenues? Do you have any avenues?
No. You're held
like
in military law.
Basically, the writ of what it does is it.
I mean, hunger strikes. I mean, something. I mean, you got to have some options.
Right.
No.
Legally, you don't have writ of habeas corpus, I don't think, even.
Yeah, because first off, you're falling under UCMJ, which is like a whole different ball of wax to civil law.
Wouldn't a prison like that, holding people like that, at least after, say, like 25, 30 years, wouldn't it be worse than a maximum security penitentiary where you've got, like, cutthroat killers every... wouldn't it devolve into something like that if you put people into... normal, everyday people... If you put them into that kind of environment where they're completely stripped of everything, wouldn't that create kind of a very disturbing environment?
It depends how they keep them. if they keep them in,
but how
super
could you keep, we couldn't even keep Guantanamo under wraps, and it was on another. It was completely different. It's not even on the continent.
No, but under the same thing, if they get an island somewhere and they just dump people on there and just don't let them leave, they're effectively in jail. They didn't have to throw them into a physical building. That's probably what they're going
to
do.
So that definitely was not put in, that they were actually having to be held in an actual penitentiary.
No, it's just that they're going to be held by the military. Now, for practical purposes, the military will probably throw them in jail somewhere, but the odds of them actually being supermax isn't very likely, simply because I don't think the military has any facilities.
Because you can't really hide facilities like that very easily.
Right.
At least,
for example, look at Gitmo. They've got some physical structures there, but it's nowhere near supermax.
There's a difference between detention and imprisonment.
No, there's apparently a difference between detainee and prisoner as well, I guess.
Probably, it depends to who. For the guards, probably not very. For the prisoners, depends on, who you tick off inside there. I don't think it'll be much different from most other prisons in that respect. You're probably going to have to listen to the rules more, because you don't have the legal resource you do in a civil prison, like if the guards beat you up. So you really don't want to think of the guards if you're in military prison, because they've got a lot more leeway to do things to you.
I think the issue ultimately boils down to it's not what prison they put you in, it's the fact they can do it indefinitely.
Exactly.
And you don't have writ of habeas corpus.
Yep.
I mean, that's ultimately the problem. So it's the slippery slope. Where I land doesn't really matter. It's the fact they put the banana peel under my heel that's
yep.
the problem.
Yeah, I don't care how nice the prison is.
Yeah, it's all prison.
Yeah, I just wanted to touch on what this guy was saying real quick about whether or not anybody's already been detained. I was reading somewhere, and I can't remember what the source was, but after this previous case, the previous lawsuit that had come out, the judge had asked the Obama administration if anybody was currently being subjected to the indefinite detention. And they could not and still have not come up with an answer whether or not anybody is currently detained under it.
Like as not, they won't. And,
right.
And unless it comes out that someone actually was, and they walk up and ask the question, and they say, and they can go, well, you know what? Here's someone who has been detained and lay it out. You'll probably never hear a yay or nay from them.
And there's the rendition program, which is kind of similar, but it's...
Going on what he said earlier... since the Patriot Act, the government can read your emails. They can tap into your cell phones. They track your bank records. A case in point, not of detention, but on September the 2nd, I'm from Tennessee, even though this is in the opposite corner of where I live. For 20-some years, this gentleman would basically work, save up money, buy a one-way plane ticket down to Mobile, Alabama, buy a bunch of Christmas trees, rent a truck one way, drive it back to Memphis and sell Christmas trees, and that's how he supported his family for Christmas. With the passage of the Patriot Act, they tracked him down, and he was arrested. I can't remember the fallout of it, but the simple fact that he'd been doing it for 20 years, but they tracked his bank accounts, they tracked his plane ticket one way, they tracked his truck rental one way. His history was irrelevant.
What was
I can't remember his name. It was in 2002. He was from Memphis. And he'd been doing that for like 20 years.
But what was he charged?
No, not tax evasion. Just suspicion of terrorism, buying a one-way ticket, using cash to make a purchase, getting a rental truck one way with cash. It was all on cash.
He was
both.
Bear in mind for this.
Now, I don't think they held him for long, but.
When law enforcement looks at this sort of thing, they don't really care who the person is. They're looking for patterns.
Right.
And they profile a particular pattern as certain actions. And it sounds like he met that pattern.
Oh, he did.
At which point, I think properly, in this case, he kind of got screwed by it. I think they should have done more research before they went in after him. But I would, barring them going for further detail before doing anything, I don't think they necessarily did anything bad as far as the intention, because the pattern is definitely an established one. And he absolutely met it. I do think they should have looked into it further, you know, before actually arresting him. But at the same time, that was like at the height of the hype and the hysteria. And had something, you know, had he actually been up to something and they had missed it as a result, they would have caught all kinds of grief for it. So I think a lot of why they didn't do the more detailed background was simply they were covering their own butts. Because I know a big thing with 9/11 was that, you know, you've got all the conspiracy theories about they knew about it and they didn't do anything, that, you know, they purposely let it happen. And you've also got the ones where they had the intel that something was going to happen, they just didn't know what or where. You know, so a lot of what we're seeing as sort of the preemptive stuff is essentially pattern matching and then them covering their butts, and no one can come back afterwards and say, well, you had this information, why didn't you do something about it? Because when it comes back to the public really doesn't care that you're looking after someone's individual rights if they've done something bad. And the politicians at that point are all about what the public wants when they get that upset. So the public in general there has to do with that, with building that hysteria, because they're the ones demanding the action. Your legislature actually enforces it, but they're following the public hysteria that, you know, all this is creating from that there. So the people should be the ones going, well, first thing off, why were his rights not looked after? And they should be doing that right after something like that, not 6 years down the line like we are now.
You had mentioned, or he had mentioned a bit earlier, that there was no statement regarding who may be detained under NDAA. Does this include Bradley Manning?
I believe he's subject to...
I was going to say, with him being in the military, he's already out of the loop. He is by default subject to UCMJ above anything else.
So he wouldn't be applied to any of the NDAA clauses?
He doesn't need to. He's already there. Simply by joining the military, you sign away a number of your rights.
Yeah.
And submitting to the UCMJ is one of them. The problem is that the NDA says we can subject regular citizens to the UCMJ.
So does that mean it would have to be the military itself, or could it be local government police, FBI?
No, it says the United States military shall detain. For non-U.S. citizens, for U.S. citizens, it says they're not required to detain.
But it's an option.
But it's an option. It implies that there's an option. When the statute doesn't prohibit something, it says, you know, it's basically they can. So.
So what may happen there is that just from a manpower source, you may have a group like the FBI or something actually performing the action, but at that point they then hand them over to the military, if the military's not doing it themselves from the get-go.
Actually, I have two questions. How much of the NDA do you think is actually just like a response to the sovereign citizen movement? Even though that's an oxymoron, but you know, how much you think is actually responsive since they're protected by the Constitution. As long as they don't commit a violent crime, the government can't do nothing to them, no matter how much they, you know, expose the government for what it stands for. And my other question is, because you were talking about if somebody sees under the NDAA, how they're under military jurisdiction. Well, I mean, this country's been under a state of emergency now for decades and decades and decades. I mean, the gold fringe flag, which is military jurisdiction, flies in every courtroom in America. Every police officer has a military flag, even though they're supposed to be, you know, defending common law, which they're not. They have a gold fringe flag, which is a flag of the sea, a maritime flag, a flag of war. So it's like, I mean, they're kind of just seizing us over whatever jurisdiction we are. So, I mean, why? I mean, they can just literally, I mean, it kind of goes back to the whole sovereign thing. I mean, they can just take us wherever they want, just throw us in jail. I mean,
I see it as an ongoing battle. That's why I see it. It's like, you know, it's our job to fight against that kind of persecution. And a lot of people, I'm not going to say everyone in government, but a lot of people, I think, well, they're, I don't know, we call them sociopaths or what, but sadists, but they have a fetish for controlling others and abusing them, and, you know, need to weed those people out. So I see that, I see your issue with the sovereign, I see the sovereign citizen issue. I don't know much about it, that movement, but I would imagine that that's a common theme with them. You know, just basically in general, that's true with a lot of the
situations. Like, is not, I think while the, like, the sovereign group may fall underneath it, I don't really think it was designed with them in mind. They were just like a useful catch of week, hey, we can take care of them as well. And as far as in the state of emergency, that's very different from living under military rule. For example, if you've got a guard who's on duty and they challenge you and you don't stop, by default they can shoot you right then. Cops can't. They may tase you, but soldiers pretty much shoot to kill. And living under emergency rule does suck, but it's quite a bit different from living under military rule.
Yeah, because like, you know, we're supposed to be, if there's no injured party, you know, we're supposed to be in a common law jurisdiction if there's no injured party, you know. But it's like, if you go, like, one time I went for the court to a speeding ticket, and the judge asked me, how do you plead? I told her I do not consent, I waive the benefit. She told me to sit down. They went through all the other cases.
Well, you do not consent to what?
I said I do not consent, and I waive the benefit, because, I mean, there's no injured party. I mean,
okay.
I mean, how, you know. And she basically told me to sit down and not to leave the courtroom or she'll have me arrested. Basically, she left. I mean, went through all the cases. Everybody left. Nobody was there. I went home because there was nobody stopped me. 2 weeks later, the cops came to my house. They didn't ask me who it was. They came with a picture from an old driver's license. And they arrested me. They took me down to the station. I sat there for like 3 hours, and they told me I was free to go. And the funny thing is, if you go to DeKalb County's website, you know, where they list the cases, this is like 4 years ago, and the case is still open. And it's like, I talked to a lawyer. He says you can have a motion dismissed, but, you know, if you do that, they could always, you know, come back after you. So, like, if it's been 3 years, they probably don't care about it. But it's like, why aren't we allowed to exercise common law jurisdiction if there's, like, no injured party? I mean, it's all going back into, like, the NDA. It's like almost they don't view us as persons. It's like,
I don't think that has anything to do with the NDAA.
No. I mean, it's like the government's not even following the jurisdictions that, as natural people, we're supposed to be governed under. So, I mean, how, I mean, in that case, with the NDA, they can do whatever they want to, not even.
Yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong on this, but like is not the reason you got arrested was most likely contempt of court for, like, leaving the court without the judge's permission. I don't know if that's actually what happened, but that's my guess as to the most common thing. And that's pretty much probably just because you pissed the judge off. It's that simple. It's their courtroom, their rules, and it's pretty much been that way since day one. They're pretty much God in that courtroom.
Yeah, I think, like, you're touching, I don't know a lot about the sovereign citizen movement, but you're talking about common law jurisdiction, like, asserting those rights and you waive them. But I kind of sense from that, I mean, in a sense, the law is kind of arbitrary. It's one person imposing their rules on other people, in a sense. So, you know, is that kind of where that sovereign citizen movement comes from?
It's like if there's no injured party, then what crime do I commit? I mean,
right, but if there's a, but they're saying that, right, they're saying that it is a crime under our law, and you're saying it's not a crime under
I'm not saying,
my
but,
law.
you know, but I'm saying a speeding ticket is a state code. It's like, I'm not a corporation, I'm a breathing person, so why should, as a breathing person, be subject to corporate law? I mean, there's the gold fringe flag right behind the judge. I mean, it's like, it's pretty obvious because flags determine jurisdiction of the court. So why am I being subject as a corporation, as a, you know, whatever, when I'm, you know, I didn't hurt anybody, I didn't do anything. I mean, it's just basically I'm being treated as a, like a, almost like, it's like they're viewing me as nothing more but a revenue source for something that I didn't do anything to anybody. And it's like, then I stand up for myself and they, I mean, I just don't get it. It's like...
Effectively, the reason you're subject to it because they've got the guns. That's what it boils down to. They've got physical force behind them in the long run.
I mean, because when you only have common law, equity law, and maritime admiralty law, it's pretty easy to, you know, X out what you're being tried under, because...
No, because I mean, if it was that simple, we wouldn't have as many lawyers as we do. I mean, lawyers, when this is bread and butter for lawyers, is, you know, is interpreting this and finding this and arguing this. And if you're a defense lawyer, you really want a lawyer who's good at that. If you're the defendant, you really don't want a prosecuting lawyer who's very good at that. But essentially, it boils down to, if you don't like it, you need to talk to your representatives at whatever level the rule is and petition them to change it. Were you here? No, you weren't here. We had a wiretapping panel, and one of the cases was brought up that there was a town in just south of San Francisco that had put in a surveillance system, and pretty much the entire civilian population was against this. And they petitioned the mayor, and the mayor was like, yeah, no, we're keeping the system. So some hackers got into the system and using the system tracked the mayor and found out he was having an affair. So they downloaded pictures and video, sent it to him and said, this is what people do with the surveillance system. Do you still want it? And he passed a law that says this town will never be under surveillance. So I'm not telling you go hack the judge's thing, whatever, but that's how you change there. You've got to talk to the person who can actually make the change to convince them.
Yeah, everybody remember basic civics? Okay, basic civics, the original founding of the country, in fact, it was paraphrasing the Patriot very nicely, where he said, why should I settle for 3,000 tyrants locally, a mile away, for one tyrant 3,000 miles away?
I saw that movie too.
Yeah, and he has a point. And the point of our original government and the way it was set up was that you can't trust government as far as you can throw the entire Dragon Con. And that it is our duty as citizens to watch them like a hawk, and that you should expect them to do things like the NDAA, and when they do, we say no. So now that we know, what are you going to do?
And that's really what it boils down to. The U.S. population is incredibly politically apathetic. We like to complain. We don't really like to get involved, unless it's something that which affects us, you know, we're involved with something directly.
But that's not the bet. That's not good, because...
Right.
And if you wait until something affects you directly, it's too late. It's just, you know, like, right.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah, that expression, right. Exactly.
Yep. And yeah, because, I mean, we're based on the principle of stare decisis, which means that we go by what's already been decided. So the longer you wait, the more, you know, the more cases there will be that you're going to have to fight against to get something overturned. The quickest way you can get something overturned is before it's ever been ruled on. Just because you've got that much less case law to fight against later on. So if you've got a problem with it, write to your Congress folk. Don't really do petitions, because petitions count. If you get 10,000 votes, they'll count it as one complaint. If you get those 10,000 people to all write in individually, they'll count it as 10,000 complaints. So just signing a petition, you're not really doing a whole lot. Take the time, write a letter, make a phone call, get your name into that office and tell them, I'm choosing one way or the other, and if you want my vote, you will do what I want, which is really how it should be.
We're getting close on time. We've got three questions left.
Oh, okay, we got three? All right.
I'm curious to hear from that guy right there. The mask.
Yeah.
If you want to take them in order of importance.
go ahead.
Okay, seriously, we'll make this as brief as possible. I know a lot of people in the military They're not jarheads, not all of them. No, a couple of those still, but they're not all jarheads. A lot of them are free will, very, very, you know, courageous individuals. I really, at the moment, I kind of doubt that if they ever said, yeah, turn the guns this way. I really kind of doubt that any. I would hope that they would have the common decency to refuse an order like that. I mean, I would hope it was like dire circumstances, zombie apocalypse or something. I mean, come on. But yes, and that categorically occurred because the winds of the media kind of shifted one way, and they just kind of stayed that way. But here we have debate back and forth. We have open forums. We have a lot of things that just did not exist back then.
Can you?
But exactly, and I appreciate the. But it comes down to what are they actually going to use it for? That's my question. Well, it shouldn't, but because of the vague words, they are already in print, they are already in action, they are already, if they are in use, then I would say we need to know what is being used for. But if you're talking about the vagueness of the statute itself, then yeah, I think that if you can go in and correct that, please do it right away. Can we do that? Is that possible? Or is it set in stone, at least until the next president gets in office?
Congress can always go and change it if they want to. But
they can change it, write a letter.
Habitually they do this act every year, so you would expect them just to...
Wait, so this will expire next year, or is it just set in stone?
Doesn't expire, they just do another one to give the military more money for the next year.
Essentially, the NDAA itself isn't bad because it's authorizing money for the military and that sort of thing. The problem with this were like two things that were added to this one for this year.
Right.
There's absolutely no reason they can't repeal them. But it's going to take individuals writing to the folk who can repeal that saying, repeal this.
Well, here's one to write some letters.
Yeah.
I just, since this is cutting out quickly, I just want to tag on to what you're talking about. 10,000, sign a petition. Instead, contact your representative. I just want to see a show of hands, barely see a show of hands through this. Do you know your local congressman?
Tom Price, District 12.
Then we live near each other.
And if you don't know, just Google who is my local congressperson.
Get there's apps for your phone to do this.
Or congress.org.
To find out what they're voting on. To track. And you can, it's a simple submission, and you can say yay or nay on every single thing that they vote on, your local representatives, senators, and congressmen.
Get into a habit. Take like 20 minutes a day. Just check what they're doing. Make sure they're doing what you want them to be doing. And it's really that simple.
Hopefully this will be fast. Okay, so they wrote this language in there. What in your estimation is their purpose for writing that? Not in the, you know, dystopian, they're just sadists, but that there's some actual purpose. What would you assume the purpose of that language would be at this time?
Well, my opinion, I mean, assuming, let's say, someone who actually honestly believes that this is good and they have good intentions, I think their purpose would be to, you know, and give the government more power or more ability to go after bad people. But the problem with it is that you get the people in office who are going to abuse it. And so you have to take into account both types of people when looking at a piece of legislation. You can't just say, well, as long as the people are, we'll give them all this power, if they're good people, you know, we're okay. So you have to make a statute, you know, good in and of itself. So regardless of who uses it, we'll use it for the purpose that you want it to be used for. You know, and that's the problem with the statute.
Right, I understand the problem with the statute. Yeah. I want to know what the purpose of it is.
Exactly that.
Right, if you assume someone who, right, the purpose, well, I don't know what you mean by purpose, because Congress doesn't attach a purpose to a bill, really. I mean, that you have to go through and read the statutory language to kind of get the purpose. And so I guess you could say that the purpose, you know, it gives a lot of power to the government to go out and get people who are doing belligerent acts and things against us. So that, you know, the stated purpose would be, you know, to protect us, I guess. But does that sort of answer your question? Or
Not really. The only way to really know, I mean, there's no way, sometimes it's hard to tell from a bill. what the thought process was.
What you do is you watch
C-SPAN and you find out there really wasn't much behind it. And so ultimately what it boils down to is you can count on the government periodically doing something like this, which is then we have to do our job, which is to go write your congressman and say, no, stop that. Go back, do it again. Kind of like your teacher says you're going to do that again and again and again until you get it right. Well, we have to do the same thing.
Yeah, because we're supposed to be government by the people, for the people. And we don't get involved enough to be for the people. And in a democracy, we wind up getting the government we deserve because we choose who goes into office and we choose how long they stay there. And by either voting for them or not voting against them, we also silently consent if we don't vote that, you know, we're happy with what you do. If you vote no, you're saying I disagree. And if you vote yes, you say, I agree. So you have to get out and vote. And just sitting at home going, I'm protesting, not voting, effectively, you're giving silent consent because that politician is going to stay in power. They're going to keep doing what they're doing because they're staying in power. The only way to make the politician change his mind is to risk his power.
And I was going to read a few quotes at the end real quick from people, the legislators who were passing and voting on this. Senator Lindsey Graham, I don't know if any of you know who that is, says, shut up, you don't get a lawyer, you're an enemy combatant. That was one thing he said. Senator Feinstein was saying, we are not a nation that locks up its citizens without charge. Well, I would say that the language of the statute is otherwise. Senator Graham also said they should not be read their Miranda rights. They should not be given a lawyer. They should be held humanely in military custody and interrogated about why they joined Al-Qaeda and what they're doing to all of us. So there's a lot of that warmongering type language that kind of maybe you can discern the purpose behind the bill with a lot of that. But, you know, there are good intentions too, I'm sure, but, you know.
The road to hell is paved with
good
intentions.
Well, I want to thank you all for coming. And thank you, our panelists here, for such for moderating. What's up? I think Hacking 201's up next in about 20 minutes.
And remember to give blood and encourage others to go give blood. Thank you for those who have given.